Welcome to the Power Press Podcast. My name is Mackenzie Bennett, and I'm your host. On this podcast, we share information to empower your podcast. This week's guest is Jason Lustig. Thanks for being on.
Hi, Mackenzie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Glad we got it figured out, and looking forward to talking about your show called Jewish History Matters later on.
Yeah.
We've got two topics, talking about your show in the middle, and then a Power Press tip at the end of the episode, thanks to Sean Thorpe. So this first article that I wanted to discuss with you is the NPR Ear Training Guide, obviously put out by NPR, but quite a while ago.
It's an older article, but I think perennially useful.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it came out January of 2017, but it has three main focuses called recording problems, editing problems, and mixing problems, and really gets into some details and some the nitty-gritty things that can happen when you are recording and then dealing with the aftermath of a recording. So there's a lot of good info in here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I probably need to take a better look at it myself, honestly.
Yeah. This was something that I saw. You know, I started my show about a year ago, or that's really when I started looking into the practicality of starting a show, you know, last fall. And this was one of the first things that I came across, just Googling, you know, how do you make a podcast? And of course, NPR is kind of like the king of podcasts, right?
Right.
Or at least the king of, you know, really serious radio in the U.S. And so this, I think, is a tremendous resource, this kind of expertise, you know, from people who are doing radio professionally, that they're sharing with, you know, folks who are doing it in a much less professional fashion. You know, podcasts are really an indie medium, essentially, you know, when you look beyond NPR and some of the other, big networks.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people will say that NPR has a certain recording style and a certain sound, and that everyone, or, you know, at least a significant amount of people would love to emulate. And they're fully aware of that. This makes sense.
Well, no, I think it's important, right? Because I think that when we think about people coming to podcasting as podcasters, usually we're used to listening to NPR, whether we listen to it ourselves or we look at kind of the most professionally produced podcasts that are out there. Mm-hmm. And NPR is kind of it's the thing that you want to be, right? Not in content, then, in terms of how you sound, because it does sound, so fantastic. And I remember, when I started working with my audio editor, that he was like, what do you want to sound like? Tell me about the sound. And I was like, well, I want to sound like NPR.
Right.
And so I think that NPR is essentially the gold standard of talk radio in terms of the sound. This is such a fantastic resource just in terms of, sort of giving people the some of the secrets to how it is that they produce it, from recording all the way through, the final production. I mean, I think for me, it was essentially a kind of a remedial crash course in what is audio? How does it get produced from start to finish? I was living in LA when I started the podcast. And so I had some friends, who worked in the business, on the audio side.
Yeah.
And they gave me some tips. But it's hard to do, what people are doing professionally without the kind of equipment that that they really have. I mean, I'm sitting here with a, with a Yeti microphone. Mm-hmm. This is nothing particularly fancy. Though there are, I think, a lot of people who are working with less. But, I think the NPR guide is really useful because it helps, no matter what you're using equipment-wise, to think in some of these theoretical terms, about, where do some of the problems come from, how you can mitigate them pretty easily, like this whole idea of, like, apple juice, right? That if people have a lot of mouth noises, that you just sip on some apple juice while you're recording or just beforehand, instead of coffee, for instance. This is pretty low-key, accessible, and really useful knowledge that you don't need a big budget to use.
Absolutely. This kind of takes care of a variety of issues that people will have. Specifically, I think I would want to take a look at the mixing problems area, because the recording, I feel like, for the most part, I'm comfortable with and pretty knowledgeable at this point, at least of my system. So I'm not really worried about it anymore. The mixing problems, I'm looking at some of their topics, talking about inconsistent levels and abrupt things that happen, like in the background, and how to get that out of it, and how to deal with perhaps someone's mic just got messed up at one point, and you're like, but I really want to try and save it. Those are the things that I think I really would want to take a look at which I don't really have those typical issues in my recordings, but that doesn't mean that they'll never happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that happens a lot, especially with remote interviews, right?
Yes.
That we can control our own recording, but there's no way to deal with, there's really no way to micromanage, or neither should we want to, our guests, especially when they're, you know, even across the world.
Yeah.
But the fact that we can even do it in the first place is pretty wild.
Yeah.
But there are always issues. You know, I've had recordings where my guest, you know, has a ton of reverb, you know, or where they clearly were, you know, not talking into the mic. And it's this question, you know, how do you salvage these recordings? And I think, you know, the big takeaway from this NPR piece and, you know, a lot of other kind of similar articles is that, you know, you really want the cleanest recording that you can get on the way in, you know, garbage in, garbage out, right?
Yeah,
But there's always going to be garbage to some extent. And the question is, how do you get around it? Part of it also is I think that that most podcasters have experience with the recording side of things. You know, this is what we do when we're making the podcast, we're recording it. And then there's a subset of podcasters who do all the mixing and mastering themselves. And then there are others who have an engineer, you know, or an editor who works with them on that stuff. But I think that that side of things is where most people, you know, can get lost easily, which is why we hire people to do it.
And there is nothing wrong with hiring someone to do it. But it is one of those things that I would prefer to learn myself, just as someone that is working for a podcasting company. I feel like this is something that I should be educated on. And as a podcaster, it's one of those things that you're like, all right, I'm going to learn certain things over time. I'm not going to learn everything possibly, or maybe that is what you want to do. Maybe you do want to learn everything. This is a good source of knowledge for you.
Well, yeah. You know, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, I've sort of shared this article with some friends you know, who have asked about podcasting, you know, because it provides sort of a theoretical basis for all the things.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, even if you are working with somebody, you want to speak the lingo. You want to be able to tell them, you know, what's going right, what's going wrong, you know, what you think needs fixing. And if you get an audio recording back that you don't really like, you want to be able to say, well, there's X, Y, and Z that just sounds off.
Yeah.
And so I think that some of these tips on, you know, on mixing, like you mentioned, levels, this is really key because it also helps you to give your guests a sense of what they should be doing. You know, I did an interview with a colleague in person, and even there were issues, right, where he, you know, would sort of move around, you know, not talking to the mic, you know, leading to level problems.
Right.
And, you know, you need to know that this is an issue so you can kind of coach your guests so that they know what to do, because you might have experience doing it over the course of however many months or years that you've been working on your podcast. But by its very nature, your guests essentially are, you know, total newbies.
That's very true. I don't really run into that issue as much because I'm interviewing podcasters. But
right.
A big portion of people that are on shows in that interview process have never been on a podcast or have no idea how audio equipment works or anything like that. I mean, they're just like, cool, I'm going to sit here and have a conversation. I don't know what is happening other than that. So you have to, you know, a lot of the time, you're correct. The host has to be that guide for their interviewee or partner or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, in my experience, you know, the sort of response to this kind of coaching is either like, you know, kind of awe, like, how do you know all of these things, right? Or something like, you know, okay, what do I have to do?
Yes.
And, you know, that's part of the reason why I think, you know, especially with remote interviews, the challenge is so great. You know, besides the fact that you're not looking the person in the face, you know, you can't really have that kind of in-person rapport that you would have in any other kind of, you know, real conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are all of these challenges, you know, that your audio might sound pristine and perfect, but your guest, you know, just sounds like crap.
It happens. It's always going to happen at some point.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and the truth is that I've seen some podcasters who've put together guidelines for their guests to sort of summarize a lot of these things from the NPR article.
Definitely.
Some other similar ones, especially on the recording side, but also kind of the lessons from the mixing side.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like a lot of things, and I think we'll talk about this in just a minute, you know, regarding my podcast in particular, you know, the real challenge is to communicate, you know, these kind of technical details to your guest. In a way that they'll understand, you know, having never looked at it before, maybe never even thought about recording before. And this is a real challenge. And the folks at NPR have put together this and other resources also, because I think that they recognize that they're experts. People starting out creating a podcast, you know, are not. You know, they're just, you know, getting their feet wet. This was certainly the case with me a year ago when I was, you know, starting my own podcast. And, you know, it's a big learning curve. And I also think the audience understands this too, right? That we should be developing over time into better audio producers.
Yes.
I mean, certainly if you pull up the, you know, very first couple episodes that I did, you know, you compare them with what I'm doing now, it's totally different in terms of how it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
you know, podcasting is a challenge, but it's also a process.
It's never going to be the way that you want it to be the first episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is true with any kind of project or any kind of skill that you're developing.
Oh, yeah. This just happens to be public. That's the thing. When people freak out about launching their podcast or something like that, they have such high expectations sometimes of they need to sound like NPR right out the gate. And that's, I feel like people put too much pressure on themselves sometimes. And a medium that is so available to indies, because if you are working for a radio station like NPR, like you came in with some type of training to work in audio. You didn't just get that from nowhere. You know, they didn't just hand that job to you to be in that expert situation. You learned it somewhere else. But in podcasting, a lot of the time from everybody else is you're just figuring it out.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is that NPR isn't perfect either, mm-hmm. right? You know, this is one of these things I think that after doing podcasting for even just a little bit, you start to see these things
and
where they made mistakes or just, you know, where the sound just doesn't sound great. And this happens again when they're doing especially remote interviews.
Yes.
You know, there have been times when, you know, they even say it on the air, right? You know, we apologize in advance, you know, mm-hmm. that they're on the cell phone. And it's the only way we could get, you know, the mayor of Los Angeles or whoever, you know, for a short, you know, soundbite or interview. And, you know, so they are also dealing with these same issues. And I think it's a reminder of two things. You know, the first being that podcasting is not radio. That, you know, even if we look to NPR as kind of a gold standard of what we might want to sound like, you know, we're doing something different. At the same time, they face the same challenges that we do.
Mm-hmm. They definitely do.
Yeah.
We're all, you know, regardless of NPR, iHeart, Gimlet, Panoply, anything, you're all being able, you know, we're all trying to do the same thing here. We're all just trying to get people to hear the story that we're trying to tell.
No, I think that's it's an important point that you're bringing up here, right? You know, what's the difference between NPR and an indie podcaster?
Mm-hmm.
Well, besides the fact that, you know, we don't have the professional training that somebody might gain over the course of, you know, however many years, you know, working in the field professionally, the difference is that just a question of budget and production,
yeah.
that we don't have those resources behind us. And so a fundamental question, and this is something that I've really tried to engage with, you know, over the course of working on my podcast, and I'm sure that a lot of people sort of have this same experience, is this question of, you know, how do you produce something that sounds really great without a huge budget, right? Or even without any budget at all.
Yep.
And how do you produce something like that, you know, without spending all your time on it? Because you easily could. You could, you know, edit out all the try to find, you know, all the ways you can tighten the audio to make it as short as possible. You really produce a really highly produced product, but then, you know, you have your real job, right? Or you have mm-hmm. your other kind of projects that you want to pursue. And so this question is, how do you balance these things? And I think that it's really easy to just throw money at a problem. But the question is, how do you balance these kind of resources? This NPR guide is like one way to get started with this, to think about, you know, how do you solve these problems at the front end? You know, how do you, you know, on a low budget, you know, think about, you know, resolving some of these issues that they still face even when they have, you know, $10,000 mics?
It's a matter of each different scenario. It really is. I mean, this is a great segue into actually talking about your show, because I want to hear how you have tackled these problems. So
yeah.
give me some background on Jewish History Matters and, you know, why you started it.
Yeah, sure. Jewish History Matters is a project that I started, you know, about a year ago. I published my first show in January 2018 with the aim of trying to bring some of the newest scholarship in Jewish history and Jewish studies to a wider audience. I think that on kind of a fundamental level, that history matters, you know, that when we talk about our sort of broad social and political context, that, you know, we are always, even if we aren't doing it in a conscious way, we're always sort of thinking about the past, how we got here, you know, where we're going. And, you know, as a scholar of Jewish history, which is, you know, what I do, you know, as my day job, right? I'm a historian. Mm-hmm. I think a lot about, you know, what is the, you know, the broad implication, you know, of what's happening in academia, you know, that a lot of times the, you know, articles, you know, and books that get published are not that accessible, you know, either because people can't get to them or they can't understand them for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You know, they're filled with jargon, or, you know, just, you know, you need, you know, a PhD to begin, you know, to understand what's going on. And the question is, how do you communicate that to a wider audience? And so I started the show kind of with that aim in mind, to do that myself, to try to translate some of, you know, what's going on in sort of the field of Jewish studies, you know, for a wider audience, and also to try to get scholars and academics to think this way as well about their own work. and to start a conversation about, you know, the contribution that studying the past has to our wider social landscape.
Wow. Actually, really in tune with what we were talking about last week as well on the podcast was education and the fact that you are a historian and want to focus on being able to broaden the scope of what, you know, people can understand on a topic that can be very convoluted like this is, you know, a perfect example of why someone should have a podcast and be listening to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
You started about a year ago, and how was the, what steps did you take to kind of get started and get the show up and running?
The first step that I took really, and this is in a certain way tied to sort of my whole sort of interest in starting a podcast, was I just started listening to everything.
Yeah.
You know, I already was listening to a ton of podcasts. I was living in LA, you know, kind of had the, you know, the stereotypical LA commute.
yeah.
And, you know, really, and this gave me a lot of time to think about a podcast, mm-hmm. you know, because among other things, you know, I realized, you know, what's out there and what can be, you know, what could be a contribution to this, you know, kind of discourse that's out there. You know, I listened to a bunch of podcasts where they talk about, you know, food history, you know, stuff like that. And it really intrigued me in terms of, again, you know, thinking about how everybody's dealing with the past in one way or the other,
right.
And thinking about it, or, you know, even we don't think about it, right? Like the food that we eat or cookbooks or whatever. And so I think, and this was really my starting point. And I think that this is a great place for a lot of people to start when they are looking at starting a podcast or any other kind of, you know, project like this, which is to say, you know, what's out there? You know, what can I contribute? What would be my niche? And, you know, for me, started to think about how what I'm doing could be different from some of the other podcasts that deal with history or that deal with Jewish history in one way or the other. I mean, I think this is kind of essential kind of quote unquote market research that's really necessary whenever you start a project. If you just jump into it, you aren't going to have a direction or a sense of what it is that you want to accomplish, which I think is the other thing, which is really need to start out with a kind of a mission.
I agree.
You know, a goal that you want to accomplish. If, you know, you just want to have a kind of stream of consciousness podcast, you know, just talking with your friends or with your colleagues, but that's not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. No one wants to hear that. I mean, maybe they do, right?
But for the most part, it's unnecessary.
Well, that's, you know, a lot of podcasts are like that,
yeah.
Right? And, you know, so I thought about also what's being done in the field of Jewish history, mm-hmm. and in the field of history at large. I really wanted to think through how is it that, you know, people think about the past? How is it that sort of average people, you know, encounter, you know, history? And, you know, there are a lot of history podcasts out there that are kind of more narrative in style, just kind of telling history or engaging with historical topics. And, you know, one of the questions that I wanted to think about and that I tried to do in the podcast is to look at history from a more academic point of view and to try to engage with the scholars, you know, not just getting them to tell, you know, what it is that they're doing or to, you know, provide historical knowledge or historical details, but to really get into the debates and why they actually matter.
One of the things you were talking about was having a direction that you wanted to go. And so how did you decide what yours was going to be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of like I already mentioned, you know, I'm a big believer in the idea that history is important, mm-hmm. and that our lives can be enriched, our politics can be, you know, more nuanced through having a kind of historical context that I think is missing a lot of the time. And this to me was really the driving, you know, force when thinking about this, you know, this podcast, was just to say, why is it that Jewish history matters? I think that, you know, for a lot of people, they look at a field like Jewish history and they think, oh, it's just for Jews, right? Or it's just a kind of a religious or an ethnic history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a challenge in the university too, which is just to say, you know, we are asking all the time, you know, how can we get more people to take our classes? You know, how can we interest people in this set of topics? And so for me, this driving direction that I had was to try to explore this, you know, this whole set of questions in public, right? You know, oftentimes mm-hmm. people have conversations at, you know, conferences or, you know, over coffee or whatever. And I really wanted to take this, you know, not to air any kind of dirty laundry of, you know, the field or of academia or whatever, but to do it in a way that would be engaging to a range of people, of thinking about, you know, why should people care about the Jews? You know, there are not a lot of Jews in the world, right? You know, this is a relatively small population,
mm-hmm.
you know, even just in the US, and you took that on a global scale and it's like, this is like nobody, right? You know, so why do we study them? You know, why is it that we care about Judaism, you know, or about Jewish culture, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, for me, this is an exploration of, you know, all the ways that we can talk about why studying a small group of people who have, you know, persevered over the course of time can help to illuminate, you know, all sorts of issues, whether we're talking about, migration, genocide, or about sort of the transfer of culture from one generation to the next. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in Jewish history that I think really matters. And this is not to say that other fields don't, right, or that other histories don't matter. But looking at it from my kind of professional perspective, I really wanted to engage with the set of issues in a very in-depth way.
Definitely. I don't really know if validity is the correct word, but it's, kind of branching out and hoping to get others to see why the history of this is valid in a way that is, not just for Jewish people and outside of academia like that. It's, taking it to the next level, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
So are there any other topics concerning history that you might want to do later on?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that people have asked me about, where do you want to take this podcast?
Mm-hmm.
For now, I want to keep the focus on Jewish history. That's my area of study. I think that on the whole, there's like an opening for people to be talking about, why various types of history matter.
Yeah.
And not just, that French history is important because France is an important country, right? But what is it that we learn, from the French Revolution, about the nature of politics? What is it that we learn, from the, history of England and its sort of formulation over the course of the early modern period, into the United Kingdom, that, helps us to understand Brexit, things mm-hmm. like that. I think that there's a lot to delve into. I might not be the person to do it, just because those aren't my areas of expertise,
yeah.
In terms of, my own work. But I think that there is a lot to be said about the contribution that sort of a deep historical context, that can be shared through podcasting as, an open, decentralized, democratic, so to speak, medium that I think can engender a really important set of conversations, not just about, the past in and of itself, but about how it is that we got to where we are now.
It's kind of like taking the ability of a podcast that someone thoroughly enjoys actually listening to as opposed to a typical history education setting. And this is giving someone the ability to look at actual events and things that have happened in history and get the life takeaways from them in a way that isn't just sit down, memorize some facts for a test. This is, this is a more full comprehension version of learning history.
Well, yeah, I mean, this to me is, I think, the point of history, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you think that history is just about, memorizing dates and facts, then you got it wrong.
Yes.
I think a lot of historians would agree with me on this, right? That it's the big picture takeaways that are really the most important. The challenge is, of course, that when you look at a lot of the history media that's out there, mm-hmm. whether you're talking about the History Channel, which, to be honest, doesn't have much history
no.
These days anyway, right? Or even a lot of history podcasts, they're just kind of delving into the information and not necessarily about what we can take away from it.
It's so much more than just retelling the story of what actually happened. It's the analyzing and the finding out how does this affect other things that really interest people.
Well, yeah. And again, this kind of speaks to, perhaps a kind of disconnect between scholars and everyday people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say that, like I said, I think that most scholars would agree with me on all these issues. But then there's kind of the stereotype of history as dry, data, and sort of points of information. I think that one of the important tasks that scholars have in the public sphere is to try to transform the way we talk mm-hmm. about history so that it's not just, did this thing happen or not, but, what do we learn from it?
So kind of going in a different direction for your show, when you're preparing for new episodes, do you have specific topics that you set aside and know I definitely want to get this into this season and I want to get it out at this certain time of the year? Or, do you kind of just let things go as they come?
A little bit of both, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that it's important to have a direction. Think about what are the topics that you want to engage with. And this is where I think that seasons are really useful, because if you can think ahead, plan ahead,
yep.
then you can really come up with a structure that really works. I just had a whole series of episodes, I think there were three of them, that dealt with history, and food. Those just kind of came together. And then I ended up publishing them one after the other, because I thought that they fit together. But looking forward, I'd like to do more of that, right? To think about how can you take like an overarching podcast and come up with kind of mini series that are part of it, like a handful of episodes, it could even be just two of them that engage with sort of an overarching set of issues and that you can create arcs and trajectories that people can learn from,
mm-hmm.
not just listening to a one-off episode, but that they can you know, sort of build on one thing to the next. The same way when, you know, if I'm teaching a lecture course, you know, or any other kind of course, you know, each session is not, you know, totally divorced from the next. You
right.
know, the students, you know, are building from, you know, one week to the next on what they're learning. And the same thing I think can be said about the podcast, which is to say that I try to pick out things that I think are important, you know, broadly speaking, you know, developments in the field of Jewish studies, you know, books that I want to highlight, mm-hmm. you know, projects that I think are really cool. But then the question is, how do you stitch that together into an overarching perspective that listeners can take away from?
Mm-hmm. It actually reminds me of when I was growing up, would go to church with my parents. And over the summer, obviously, the church saw lower numbers simply because people are on vacation, people want to go outside, and, you know, just less people show up during the summer. And I remember the pastor would always do a series for the summer. He would mm-hmm. do like a 2 or 3 part series so that in hopes of, you know, well, someone heard part 3, so they want to hear part 4. They heard part, you know, they want to stick around for the whole thing. It's a whole learning experience. It's a whole storytelling opportunity right there, as opposed to just something different every week, which is okay, which is perfectly fine. But there are the many, many benefits, like you said, of being able to portion things together like that, because people want to have that experience.
One thing that I'd like to try to do is to try to integrate the episodes together in a more, you know, defined way, mm-hmm. you know, where especially if I have like a series of episodes that deal with, you know, a particular, you know, area, and where I can say in one episode, like we talked about last time, how do you respond to the set of issues? I honestly haven't had the opportunity to do that too much in the course of what I'm doing. Again, this is a relatively new project. You know, I started it this year. There are people who've been podcasting for 5 years, 10 years, whatever, right? Like with the audio stuff, I think that's just a process of developing your technique, you know, developing your process.
Yeah.
And so for me, I think that, you know, one of the things that's interesting about podcasting as kind of an experiment, you know, is I think the way that I look at it, you know, still in a certain way, is how can you be constantly experimenting mm-hmm. and, you know, developing new approaches, sort of new things that you can do. If you do the same thing every single week, you know, what's the point? You know, it needs to not necessarily, you know, always be improving, but always be doing new things, you know, in as much as podcasting is not radio, right? You know, it's kind of freed from a lot of the constraints that you might have, you know, sort of with a program that's limited to a certain period of time, or that comes out, you know, at you know, every day or every week or whatever. I mean, I try to publish my show every 2 weeks, you know, when I'm putting out the episodes, but we have very few constraints in terms of our format, in terms of, you know, how we structure things, you know, so on and so forth. And I think that we should take advantage of these things to be constantly looking in new directions and trying out different things.
So, I mean, this is not your job. You're in academia. So how do you constantly experiment and make sure that you're keeping things new when you're on such a limited time and budget? This isn't your job. This is your side thing.
Well, right. So it is kind of like a side project, right? Mm-hmm. But I also see it as, you know, part of a broader interest in terms of my own work. You know, my own research is really, you know, focused on a broad inquiry into, you know, how people in the past have saw history as important, right? So in a certain way, you know, starting the podcast and thinking about these issues is not that far afield from some of the stuff that I look at, you know, in terms of writing, you know, my book or articles or whatever. But I think that, like you said, you know, it is a challenge. I think that, you know, the vast majority of people who are making podcasts, you know, and especially academics, you know, this is something that you don't necessarily get credit for.
Unfortunately, not.
Certainly don't get paid for it, mm-hmm. you know, or if you do, it's like pennies, right? And it's something that we do for fun, you know, mm-hmm. or we do because we think it's important. And so the question is, how do we do it with all the other stuff in our lives, whether that's our job or kids or, you know, or whatever else? And this is something that I've kind of been, again, experimenting with over the past year or so, trying to figure out, you know, how do you produce a podcast on a regular basis, you know, while still teaching at the same time, which is a, you know, a very intensive thing to be doing, right? Mm-hmm. While still publishing, you know, while still sort of being involved in the world, right? You know, podcasting can easily take up, you know, as much time as you want to give it.
Definitely.
And so I've tried to develop kind of techniques and strategies that allow me to make the most of the resources that I have, you know, whether that's you know, a small grant that I got to start the podcast, right? All the way up to the question of, you know, there are only so many hours in the day that you can use. For me, I spend a lot of time in the evening, realistically, right? Working on the podcast. You know, that's the time when I might have to just listen through a draft of an episode and say, you know, how does it sound? You know, where are there issues that have to get fixed? This is, I think, an important strategy in general, which is that you should use the time when you're most alert and sort of most mentally active to be doing the most mentally strenuous activities, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so sort of apportioning what you're doing to different times of the day can go a long way, you know, that you should, you know, passively listening to, you know, a draft, you know, late at night, you know, that's easy to do, right? You know, make use of the time in the car. You know, now I don't have a long commute like I did before, but you know, last year I had this hour long commute. Well, what do I do on that commute? I could, you know, listen to music, I could listen to the radio, or I could put that time to use, right? So that's one way that I do things. I've also, you know, just on a sort of basic level, tried to limit the time that I put into the project. You know, I'm a believer in the idea that projects of all kinds will kind of expand to fill whatever time you give them, right? They're kind of greedy in that way. And so I think there's this kind of perfectionism that we might have that we kind of need to get away from. And this is something that I struggle with a lot of the time, right? You want yourself to sound good, right? You want things to be perfect. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be the case. And you just kind of give into that, to this knowledge that it's just never going to be 100% perfect. And this goes back to this NPR article, right? That in a way, you know, we can try as hard as we can, but there are always going to be issues. And whether that's, you know, on a sound level or, you know, just the vocal tic that you can't get rid of from your guest without spending 10 hours, you know, listening and listening and listening and cutting carefully. With that said, I think that there are techniques and tools that we can use to really do a lot of the work that we do with a limited time budget. You know, so for instance, I found this app on the App Store called Chapter, without the E, that been so incredibly helpful to me, because what it is that you can listen to any audio file and annotate it while you're listening to it.
Nice.
So like if you click with your like headphone clicker, right, you know, you can mark it as a spot for an edit or for a chapter or for whatever. And so what I just do is I listen to the podcast, you know, and I mark it up as I'm listening, and then I can export that as a CSV file, or which can be imported into Reaper, for instance, or you know, any other thing. So I can just like see it on the timeline where I need to make changes, one thing or the other. So that's one way that I do it.
That's very helpful.
Yeah. Another thing that I've sort of done is I've been working with my audio editor, and this is key, right? We need to kind of like balance, you know, what do we have more of, you know, time or money, right?
Oh yeah.
And I don't have a ton of money or even a big budget just for this project.
Well, you don't have a ton of either.
Well, right. And the question is, how do you make the most use of it? And one of the things that I've realized is that having an editor is something that, you know, you really can't do without, you know, unless you want to spend, you know, 20 hours a week working on your podcast.
Yeah.
So I can offload a huge amount of work, you know, to my editor, who does phenomenal work on the podcast. You know, especially, you know, I've been working with a new audio editor for the past, you know, few episodes, and the difference is astounding, you know, both in terms of the quality and also in terms of, you know, what I have to do to put into the podcast. And so one of the things that I've been doing with my editor is trying out a service called Descript, which basically you plug in audio files and it outputs a transcript that you can edit.
Oh, nice.
And so I can do the basic content editing of my podcast without spending, you know, 3 hours listening to all the raw audio. You know, I can cut out the sections that I think are no good, you know, move things around or whatever. And then my editor can export that and then work on the audio directly.
Yeah.
You know, so it's stuff like that I find sometimes it saves me time, sometimes it doesn't. But on the whole, it leads to kind of more productivity. And I think that there's, you know, really a lot of interesting things that are happening in the podcast space right now, especially because there are so many people who are making podcasts. And you know, venture capitalists and you know, entrepreneurs are kind of realizing that there's this market for people who need tools. Will really, you know, help to improve their workflow. So there's a lot of really interesting things that are happening in the, you know, in the podcast world that weren't there, you know, even 6 months or a year ago.
It's definitely, you bring up a good point of there is this availability of tons and tons of different types of technology like this that can help you be more productive. And even if you try something out and you realize you weren't more productive with it, but, you know, it gave you an idea to do something else. This is part of how you learn more, but also shake up what you're doing on your podcast, because, you know, it could give you new ideas and a fresh perspective sometimes.
No, absolutely. I think that the, you know, the question, how do you produce a highly produced podcast, you know, with limited resources, time, you know, financially, otherwise,
it's a real challenge most people face.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, one of the really cool things I find about podcasting, and it's something that I talk about with folks whenever they ask me about, why did I start a podcast, is that it's just such an interesting and open-ended medium. It's totally decentralized. Obviously, people need to have a host. Blueberry's great. I'll just say that out loud, right? But, you don't need to have a website unless you really want to, right? You don't need to do a ton. I know somebody who was like going to start a podcast with some friends, and what was he going to do? He just put his cell phone down on the table, right? Turned on voice memos and started recording, and they just had a conversation. Now, it's not as good as if you have multiple mics or, whatever, but you can do it, right? The amount of resources that you can toss into a podcast are kind of limitless, right? If you have those resources to put into it. At the same time, it doesn't really require much. What this means is this really contributes to the diversity and, the explosive nature of this entire, oral expanse that we have access to. And, we see this just in terms of the numbers of podcasts that are out there. And not all of them stick around. But part of the story here is that it really doesn't take a lot of resources to put together a podcast. If you want to do it kind of in a very bare bones type of way, that's why Audacity is, still kind of popular.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's free. It's not so great. I started using it when I started out, and I quickly shifted to using Reaper just because, for me anyway, it's just so much better for a whole bunch of reasons, which I don't think we necessarily want to get into. But, there are so many tools out there, and it's almost like there's too much. Right. It's like, how do you get started with the podcast? When I started looking at this, it was like, well, where do you even get started? There's like, so much out there. This NPR article is just one place to get started, but there are 1,000 articles on where do you start with the podcast?
Mm-hmm. And you got to go with your gut. You can make it as simple as you want or as complicated as you want.
Yeah. I mean, for me, one of the things that I've most driven to do with the podcast from the beginning is to really put together something of higher quality in as much as, again, you look at what's out there and there's so much that's just very basic. And how do you differentiate yourself? So I've tried to edit my podcast heavily, sometimes more than others. Again, it's a question of time. Sometimes it's just a question of people talking and talking and talking and talking. And so how do you take that, 10-minute monologue of your guest who just wouldn't shut up and turn it into something that people can actually listen to?
Yes.
And this is a skill that takes time to develop. I fundamentally don't see audio as being that different from text. I mean, I'm an academic. I edit texts more than anything else.
Yeah.
And a big part of what I do is taking that 10,000 word article, and turn it into 5,000 words.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And this question is like, how do you do the same thing with audio? For me, it's been a challenge to try to do it sometimes. Because also you want to preserve your guest's voice, right? And what it is that they're saying. You don't want to doctor what they're saying to make them say something that they're not saying. But the question is, how do you transform your recording into this episode, or into a story that you want people to listen to? And, for me, again, it's also like, academic output is often so highly edited, so highly polished.
Yeah.
Right. And when people are just talking, it's not that way. Right. And so this question is, how do you make people sound smart? Right. And help them communicate their ideas, which is really what I've been trying to do in a lot of ways. It helps to get, people who, may not be used to talking to a public audience, to translate what they're saying into something that is understandable. And part of this is the questions that you ask. And part of this is, how do you take what they say and, and frame it in a way that is understandable? And this has to do with editing. This has to do with, when you put together an intro for your podcast or your show notes or whatever. It's a challenge and it's a project in and of itself. But I see that podcasting is just so interesting and exciting because you can do all of this or you can do none of it. For me, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the episodes as text as well. So like if you look on my website, or look at the podcast, I have show notes and stuff like that, but also I've done transcripts of episodes because I know that there are a lot of people who listen to podcasts, in the car or while they're doing dishes or whatever. And then there's a whole lot of people who never would listen to a podcast, but they'd read an article online.
Yep.
Right. So it's this question of, what's the difference in a certain way between the oral form and the written form? It's all content in a way. So, I mean, I think that with the podcasting, it's just a question of what you want to put into it. I found the project to be really invigorating and exciting, which I guess is part of the reason why I'm still doing it. Because, again, no one's paying me to do it. The real question is when you look at a podcast, how you want to do it is how you can take the resources that you have and put them to the best use.
It's a matter of manipulating the opportunities and the availabilities that you have around you into something so much more in the end than it seems like when it's just those small pieces. Like you have to, it's taking all of those elements and turning it into something full and rewarding and worthwhile for people to listen to.
Right. Especially when there are so many things that they could listen to.
Yeah.
Right. We live in this like golden age of media, right? Like not just the podcasting, but there are so many TV shows out there, you know, so many books to read, you know, and this question is like, people have so many choices. You know, how do you stand out?
That is a great segue into the topic of the last article was how to predict the death of a podcast. The what, how, and why of the pod fade phenomenon. So pod fade is, Jason, I believe you are familiar with this term, but for those that are not, it is when a podcast slowly dies, essentially, whether it is on, and it's not necessarily slowly, but whether it's on purpose or on accident, a podcast does not last forever.
Yeah. Well, nothing lasts forever.
No.
I mean, anybody who thinks that it does is being very silly.
This is kind of trying to get people to think of, do you set an ending for your show? Do you let it happen organically and tell people that, hey, I'm ending this after I've decided I've just hit my limit, I'm done? Or do you just stop uploading episodes and fall off the face of the earth?
Well, I think that is not ideal,
no.
Right? I mean, sometimes that just happens, right? You have all sorts of, you know, life events and challenges, and sometimes you just can't keep working on the podcast, you know, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But I think that, like what you said at the beginning is really key, right? Which is that I think that there's a tendency to see pod fade, right? Or, you know, ending as a defeat, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But that's not the case, right? Mm-hmm. At least in my view. I think that, you know, if your goal is to, you know, do this for the rest of your life, well, then ending is, I guess, you know, admitting defeat, right? But, yeah. You know, that is not what we should be doing, right?
No.
And I think that if we start our podcast with a goal in mind, well, we can say at a certain point, we've achieved it or it's done. And I think that if we have that kind of perspective, then, you know, the whole idea of pod fade is kind of moot in a way. I mean, I think that this article and some of the other ones on this topic are really focused more on this question of people who start a podcast and then just disappear,
yeah.
You know, after a few episodes. Like, I think the statistic is that, like, you know, if you get past 7 episodes or 10 episodes or something like that, then you've kind of like passed the, you know, the kind of fundamental threshold. Yeah, the drop off of, you know, of when you're most likely to stop doing it.
Yes.
And like everything else, it's a question of building up habits, right? You know, if you've gotten into the habit of putting on an episode, you know, once a week or once a month or whatever, and you've done it a whole bunch of times, well, you've built up these habits.
Yeah.
You built up these skills. And so you'll just keep doing it. But I think that the other half of it is just that there are a lot of people who try out, you know, who try out making podcasts and decide they don't want to do it anymore. And again, because they did it in public, well, it looks like they just stopped doing it.
Right.
But in reality, it was just an experiment and it, you know, didn't take off, or they didn't find it enjoyable, or they didn't get the audience that they expected.
It's so much more than people, like so much more work than people realize sometimes. And, you know, sometimes they're just like, yeah, sure, I want to see how this works. And so they just do that. But it's considered a show in terms of the overall number. So it's not necessarily like a concentrated effort of someone was like, I want to be a podcaster and I want to have a podcast and I want my audience, you know, I want to grow an audience to tell them this story. When in reality, that's not all 620,000 shows that exist as a podcast. That's absolutely not the case. So
Right. Well, I mean, so when you say there are 620,000 podcasts, how many of those are pod-fated podcasts? Right, they got started and then they just didn't go anywhere. Like, what percentage of the podcasts that we see are out there are defunct or whatever? Versus the number of active ones.
It's
very significant.
About 510,000 of those have not released a new episode in the last 90 days.
Wow.
Yes.
So is that number of 620,000, is that even like a valid number, so to speak?
That came from us tracking RSS feeds, like Blueberry doing that. And then the 600, I mean, iTunes is releasing numbers that high as well.
No, what I mean is that, like, it's not that it's not a valid number. It's that, like, you know, maybe the more interesting number is how many active podcasts are there.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to the number which are in the directories. Because, again, there's this huge backlog of content. You know, it's no different from, like, you know, Friends, right? Or any other kind of old TV show, right? Still out there. Not kind of necessarily as accessible, you know, because it's only available if you can get it through a streaming service or,
buy the DVDs or whatever.
Like, buy DVDs, right. I don't know. I tend to think, again, of like podcasting as part of a broader media landscape. And I think that, you know, we could do a lot to learn from, you know, what has worked and what hasn't worked in other kinds of forms of media, which is to say that, you know, TV shows have seasons, right? Why not us, right?
Yep.
That I think that having like a set of time when your podcast is going to come out provides kind of expectations for yourself and for your listeners. You know, for me, so last year I put out 10 episodes starting in January. By last year, I mean last academic year. Right. Sorry, it's just the way I think, right?
I understand.
So from January until May, I put out 10 episodes over the course of about 5 months or so. Yeah. You know, so once every 2 weeks. And you know, at a certain point, I was like, you know, I want to take a break over the summer. I happen to be moving sort of across the country anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, and I realized that it was important to kind of set expectations. A, this wasn't necessarily going to last forever. And that B, you need time to regroup and think about what comes next. I think that, you know, if we're always kind of on the, you know, on the treadmill, so to speak, you know, always putting off the next episode, you know, especially if you're on a weekly schedule, you don't always have the time to think ahead.
Yeah.
And so I think that for me, taking a break over the summer really provided the opportunity to really prep what was coming next. I did a lot of recording, you know, in the spring and, you know, into the summer to really prepare for sort of the next season, the current one that I'm putting out right now, mm-hmm. of Jewish History Matters. And, you know, for me, this was really critical to be able to sort of take this 30,000 foot perspective. Also, so that eventually, right now, meaning that like when I started putting out the episodes, the work will be done, right? In a certain way, like right now I can focus on, you know, my real work, you know, of publishing and, you know, writing and, you know, all these different things and still put out the podcast without doing a ton of work because I spent a lot of time on it over the summer.
Yeah.
And so I think that when we're talking about sort of combating pod fade or whatever, you know, it's all about developing the sort of plan for the future. If you don't know where you're going, then the odds are much higher that you're going to end up just stopping.
Yeah, it's having that goal, that direction that we were talking about earlier, but it's also relieving yourself of the perfectionism to actually just go ahead and do it. It kind of ends on a note of someone saying, you can't wait for these things to be perfect. You just have to go for it. If you can help a handful of people via your podcast, that makes, you know, that's going to make you happy. It's, what do you want out of it? It's, you know, if you just want to put out the same thing over and over and over again, go for it. If you want to take the time to refresh and, you know, use the summer wisely like you did, do it. It's your podcast. If you,
well, yeah.
if you're, you know, do what you're comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting, again, about this kind of article and, you know, the NPR one that we started talking about, too, is the audience for this stuff is people who are just getting started,
yeah.
really more than anything else, right? And so those are the folks who have the greatest challenge when it comes to this question of pod fade or of ending, which is to say that, you know, if you're just getting started, you're just thinking about doing a kind of a project, well, you got to think really seriously about it. You know, what is it that you want to accomplish? You know, how do you want to do it? How are you actually going to do it? You know, and again, this is kind of how I see podcasting is, you know, not that different from any other kind of really intensive endeavor of production of content, you know, whether that's, you know, writing an article, you know, or, you know, running an organization or anything, right? Which is to say that, you know, it's a long-term commitment if you really want to do it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, think it's a great idea. Podcasting is cool. It's hot right now, right? You know, there are more and more podcasts that are getting produced. Like, you know, it seems like every business wants to have their own podcast.
Yeah.
And the question is like, okay, you know, how do you actually do it? And most people don't have a lot of experience, you know, doing podcasts. Mm-hmm. On the production side, they might listen to them a lot, but they don't understand how much work actually goes into it.
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
People want to do it because they have the urge to, but they don't know why they should continue doing it sometimes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is something that you guys probably think about a lot at Blueberry, right? You know, you want to encourage more people to podcast. You obviously want more customers,
oh, yeah.
right? But I think people should really think hard about it, right? Like the question is not just like, oh, I want to create a podcast, but what do I want to do with it? You know, what do I want to achieve by it? This is something that I really thought about at the beginning of my podcast and I'm continuing to think through, which is this question of, you know, how can the podcast as a medium be not just an end in and of itself, but achieve sort of, you know, larger aims. You know, I think that for like a business starting a podcast, like the aim is like you're building a brand loyalty, right? You know, kind of like cultivating a group of super fans, right? So yeah. to speak, or whatever. For an individual starting a podcast with their friends or just, you know, on their own, you know, I think we need to think seriously about sort of what's the end goal, right? You know, do you want to monetize it? Well, mm-hmm. you know, how do you want to do that? You know, why do you want to monetize it? Is it just to pay for itself? You know, is it to achieve some kind of career goal? right? Or to educate the public on a certain set of issues. I see some of these and they're really fabulous, you know, podcasts that focus on, you know, current issues.
Right.
You know, well, those issues change. You know, so the question is, you know, what are you going to do when that issue is no longer as important in sort of the public eye? You know, we see this with, you know, a lot of podcasts, even the kind of the most popular ones, they're constantly changing. Like the new, series of Serial, right? You know, still focuses on, issues of criminal justice, right? But, you know, they have a new perspective, a new way of doing it. They can't keep doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly why they changed it. They did the, in my opinion, they did the right thing of, regardless of whether you like the content or not, from a podcast host and business perspective, they were like, all right, season one, we knocked it out of the park with this. Season two, not so much. Season three, we want to start with something new. That's what you do.
Yeah.
That's how things thrive.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of similar to how you have to just allow yourself to start the show. Sometimes you just have to allow yourself to decide to end it.
Right. Or hand it off to somebody else.
Yes. You know,
which is the other kind of option.
Yes. Out of those numbers, the 620 that are there, and then the 510 that haven't done anything in the last 90 days, that still leaves 110 out there that are productively putting out new episodes at this point of time. That's still a lot of shows.
Yeah. It's more than anybody can listen to in their lifetime, realistically.
Or should listen to.
If we think through our objectives, really come up with a plan, then PodFade is kind of a misnomer. Mm-hmm. And it's also like kind of a misdirection of kind of what's important, which is to say that I think that we should be okay with things ending. You know, everything in life ends. And the same thing is true with the podcast, that you work on a project and eventually you move on to something else. And I think that if you have sort of an end goal in mind, that this can be really productive. It was just to say, okay, I've achieved my goal. You know, now what's next?
And it's not to say that everyone needs to think of their podcast as a business. That's absolutely not what I'm trying to say here. But whenever people are starting a business, they typically, or at least I think they should also have an exit strategy in mind. Mm-hmm. When they are starting that, have an exit strategy in mind. That exit strategy will evolve as you're, 5 years down the line or even 6 months down the line, whatever it is, whatever your company turns into. But just have that thought so that you can continue to figure out what it is that you want to be doing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how you keep a podcast going that people want to listen to. Otherwise, it will fade out, regardless of whether that was your decision or not.
Right. Well, I mean, I think this goes back to, in a certain way, kind of the driving impulse behind what it is that I'm doing in my podcast, in Jewish History Matters, which is to say that, we always need to be asking ourselves, why is it that what we do matters?
Yeah.
What's the significance? Why should people listen to my show or anybody's show? What do they gain from it? And if at a certain point we say, we're not achieving what we meant to do, then it's not necessarily that it's time to end, but that we should be open to it. And again, this is all to say that I just kind of think it's a silly kind of a whole set of issues. We just need to have the right kind of perspective on the nature of what we do as podcasters or as writers or, as anything, that eventually you move on to the next thing.
Yeah. I just want to wrap up here real quick before Sean Thorpe comes in with the podcast tip, but Jason, give people the link of how they can listen to your show. Tell them what that is, where they can find you online.
Yeah, sure. So the podcast is called Jewish History Matters, and you can check us out, on Apple Podcasts or, wherever you find, great podcasts. You can also go to our website, which is just, jewishhistory.fm, and on Twitter at jewishhistoryfm.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. I thoroughly enjoyed the topics that we talked about, so I hope that you did and that my listeners did as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please subscribe if you have not done so, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye, everyone.
This is Sean Thorpe from the Blueberry Support Team with this week's Power Press Tip. Blueberry recently released version 7.4. of the PowerPress plugin, and that update brought a new feature to PowerPress called Skip to Position. Skip to Position allows you to easily add clickable timestamps to your show notes that allow listeners to automatically skip to the time indicated in the timestamp. For example, let's say you have an interview that starts at 3 minutes into your latest episode. The interview goes until 33 minutes, and then you have a current events segment. Using skip to position, you could create a clickable link at the 3 minute mark so your listeners could go straight to the beginning of the interview. Then you could create another link at the 33 minute mark so they could skip straight to the current events segment. You can create as many clickable timestamps as you'd like for each one of your podcast episodes. Skip to position works with both the default MediaElement.js media player that comes with WordPress, as well as the Blueberry audio player that's available to Blueberry media hosting customers. The links created by skip to position control only the embeddable media players on your podcast website. These links aren't designed to work in third-party podcasting apps. To create a clickable timestamp in your show notes, use the skip to position short code. Type a left bracket, then the text skip to as one word, a space, then the word time, and the equal sign, followed by the timestamp wrapped in quotation marks, finishing the short code with a right bracket. The default skip to position time code works with the default podcast channel created by PowerPress, but you can modify the skip to position short code to work with both custom channel and post type podcast feeds. You can learn more about skip to position as well as see examples of the feature in action by visiting create.blueberry.com and entering skip to position in the search box. And that's it for this week's PowerPress tip. If you have any questions about this or anything else in the Blueberry universe, email me, Sean@blueberry.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.